Hello, my name is Floyd Maxwell. This is a video regarding something I used to do as a child with my father, hand logging. Logging without using equipment, without using machinery, motors, noisy chainsaws, all that stuff. I want to kind of honor my father with this story and sort of try and really extract some of the nuggets from this part of my life and share them with you, because it was really kind of a big deal. It conveys or captures so much of my father's essence and so much of what he taught me all in one activity. So on each of my article pages, I choose a red, white, and blue image, and here I chose a recumbent bike that's red, white, and blue frame. My father was a cycler. He cycled when he worked at oil refineries and pulp mills, and he cycled when he worked at the British Columbia Institute of Technology. He set up and taught instrumentation in one of the departments. He rode his bike there. It was very unusual. Students would play pranks on him and take his bike and put it up on the roof and jam it into an elevator and stuff like that. My father was also into Zen. I think Zen is something that everyone should understand, at least to the point of what is it. You know, at least read enough about it so that you can go, okay, I see what that is. Because in essence, most of us, we, to use a Zen sort of analogy, we're on the big boat of life. We're doing something with others. When we are at a job, we're working with others. We walk in, we say good morning to 5, 10 people. We work with 5 or 10 people. We go to lunch and see another 5, 10, 15, who knows, 20 people, doesn't matter. And it's like this huge shared activity. But the problem is that sort of lets us off the hook of thinking our own thoughts and being accountable to ourselves. And learning. It lets us off the hook from learning. Right when we might be facing a nasty bit, someone else can bail us out, and we can laugh at their story, and just shrug off that little momentary pang of conscience that we had. In other words, in this hand-logging operation, there was some Zen. There was some bicycles. There was my unique father sharing this all with me and teaching me at the same time. And part of me, when I was looking through this document, I was thinking, oh, there's some good stuff there. I should just read this. Maybe one day I will read it. But for now, I guess what I'm trying to describe is that this hand logging became a liberation for me, because I went from being stuck going to church on Sundays. That was my mom's wish, and I had to do it for a certain number of years, and then eventually I was old enough that I could opt out, which I did quickly, immediately. And I got to experience the other side of the coin. This is a religion-dominated world. Even those who would say they don't have a deity, they are still, you could say, a brotherhood or a group that's sort of held together like a religion. And, you know, you have to march in lockstep. And Zen is just the other side of that. So with this hand-logging, for example, it started with my father deciding that he wanted to take a tree down. He usually liked to cut down alder trees for firewood. He'd start in the fall. He'd ride his bike and sort of strap on, just sort of with a bit of rope, you know, a bit of twine, ill-suited twine. He'd rope on a saw and an axe to his bike. And sometimes, some of the years I was able to go with him, even on the falling stage. But anyway, he might often just go by himself. And he'd ride down our hill. We lived in a big hill in Burnaby, a suburb of Vancouver, British Columbia. And he'd ride down this long hill until he got to the right-of-way. This is the area underneath the power lines near the water, near Burrard Inlet. And then he would just kind of hike up into the scrub, because it had all been cut down and it was just low brush, you know, maybe 10 foot high at the most brush underneath the power lines. And he would sort of make his way, maybe there was a trail there, maybe he made the trail, I don't know. And he would sort of hike up through the scrub, and then he would get just on the top side of the right-of-way, the clearance, cleared area, where there were some trees. Now, these trees, no one lived here. There was no, you know, buildings or houses or anything for a quarter mile in all directions, just about. And so these trees didn't owe anyone any favors. And there he was. He just would decide which alder he wanted, and he would saw it down. Yes, he was stealing a tree. Oh, dear. This is a story from another age, from 100 years ago. And he would saw it down with a Swede saw. Now, the Swede saws that we can buy today, typically in an American hardware store anyway, they're about 3 feet long, and they're kind of crap. They don't cut very well. They're really just good for branches, maybe the size of your wrist or so. But he had a Swede saw that was bigger. It was maybe 4 feet, 4.5 feet long. You could buy the blades for it, and they were good 3 feet long blades. similar look to the blade, but sharper, nicer metal, sharper, kind of more spring steely. And if you didn't jam the blade, because it wasn't a robust blade, it wasn't like the lumberman's two-handed saw where the blade was 6 inches deep or, you know, thick. It was 1 inch and very thin metal, and so it jammed very, very easily. But if you could avoid that in your technique, this is how you avoided using a chainsaw. So he would saw down this tree with a Swede saw. Now that, I don't think many people have ever done that. If you did it once, you sure didn't try and do it again. Like I say, the jamming factor. And here's the thing, you're sawing this tree, and it starts to jam, now what? How do you get that blade out? You don't just yank on it, you'll break the blade. He would have to bring along wedges and a hammer, and hammer a wedge in so that he could get the saw blade out. Tricky stuff. And here you are, you're only playing with a 10-ton tree that could fall on you if you make a mistake or kick back on you. Falling a tree was an adventure. I didn't always get to see it, but it was an adventure, I assure you. Then, you know, let's say weekend number two, Sunday number two, I would go with them. We'd ride our bikes, and we'd take two axes and a saw. He did all the sharpening. Saw, he did all the hand sharpening. Wrapped just with a rag and lashed onto the bikes. And my assignment was I had to delimb the fallen tree. And that sounds easy enough, you know, hack away at it and knock the branches off. Well, here's the thing. First of all, this is Vancouver, British Columbia, so it's always wet. So you're on wet ground. You're walking around where people don't normally walk around, so you might have to step up or down 3 or 4 feet. You've got stuff whipping you in the eyes. And the biggest thing of all is when you swing in a branch, how do you hack a branch? You know, there's probably 3 or 4 main ways of doing it, and 3 out of those 4 are wrong. They will be either dangerous or really difficult. The easiest way is kind of beautiful. If you were looking up at the tree, and don't do this, you would be, with your axe would be going up the tree. So in other words, the branches tend to grow upward, and you want to cut from below the branch where it starts, where it hits the trunk. You want to try and cut it off cleanly, but you're going from lower on the tree to higher on the tree, if that makes sense. The more intuitive way to try and cut it would be to cut it from above. Think of it like you got a chicken bone and you're going to cut between the two parts of the bone, you know, coming from the top of the Y. The problem is that's very hard to do and not predictable as to what you're cutting. In other words, you might, following the grain, you might end up with your axe heading towards the heart of the tree. An axe is not going to be effective in that situation. So you had to do a glancing kind of a blow, a potentially glancing blow, ideally, to the branch. Well, if it does glance, now you have an axe flying through the air with lots of energy. What's going to stop it? Not some young kid. Half the time, not some young kid. It's going to fly around and hit something else, or, whoa, that was close. My dad, you know, steady, or whatever he might say. So I was the one with the duller double-headed axe. Mine was a club in comparison to my father's axe, which was, you know, getting towards the kind of axe you see in a lumberman's show. You know, an instrument that the person has personally sharpened and knows how to use and sinks into wood when you swing it. Mine was more, doesn't swing into flesh as readily. That's how sharp mine was. So I was the branch remover, and after enough of these had been cleared, my father would start the process of bucking the tree up into shorter lengths. Well, with a chainsaw, what do? You cut it up, you know, say you want 16-inch lengths, you just every 16 inches with the chainsaw, and there you go. It can still be somewhat complicated, but nothing like using a sweet saw, a handsaw, a flimsy little handsaw. So again, he would always have to undercut it carefully, and just when it starts to bind, you have to sort of sense that. You know, you're 1 minute you're working away, yanking away on that saw, and the next minute it's binding. So sensing that, he would then have to try and get the saw out and do the top cut. And depending on how the tree was laying, this was not at all easy. The tree, with all those tons of weight, wants to fall a certain way. And if you think about it, let's say it's lying on a 45-degree angle, and you try and make a cut into it, it now wants to go from a 45-degree line to a, an obtuse angle. Think of it like you've dented the trunk. Well, the problem is when you've dented it, it's definitely going to pinch at the top. Your saw is going to bind very readily. If you've done an undercut, and right when it starts to pinch, if you're lucky, you've got to your undercut, or the undercut is, you know, sort of allowing it all to happen. I don't know. Honestly, I'd have to sit down and try it again to see if I could do it. It would probably take me a couple of goes. Well, that was my father's lot, was to make that sweet saw work. He just wasn't a chainsaw man, never ever was, and he harvested wood for decades. So he'd be bucking them up into these, you know, about 5 foot lengths. So they weren't, he didn't take a tape measure. He wasn't, for this kind of an action, this kind of an operation, he wasn't a tape measure guy. So he would, you know, just sort of eyeball it, estimate it. One of the things he would take into account was, you know, the bottom part of the tree is much heavier, much thicker in diameter, and it's heavier. And we have to flip these things out of there. And so he would, you know, make the bottom one, let's say the bottom of the tree, and typically the tree might be 12 inches in diameter, maybe 14 inches. So the bottom length might be only 3 or 4 feet. So 3 or 4 feet of a 14-inch diameter tree, let me tell you, that's, you know, probably 150, 200 pounds. You got to lift one end, you got to lift 100 pounds. That's roughly the numbers. It might be a little less than that. It might be 120 pounds, you got to lift 60 when you lift one end, something like that. So he would be doing the cutting, I'd be doing the delimbing, and here's another thing, is that as you delimb, especially if the branches are sort of interacting with other trees, which of course is happening, then suddenly the tree could shift. And it could shift quite a lot, and not only is it dangerous for us two, but the saw, if it's in there and the tree shifts, you might not get that blade back. And so, you know, my dad did have to buy blades occasionally, not very often, but occasionally. He did so many things. With his sweet saw, he rigged it up so it was adjustable. I think most sweet saws, you just sort of put the blade in and that's it. His had a really interesting kind of a rig. Sort of reminded me of the movie Quigley Down Under, where he had a really interesting kind of custom rig on his gun. This was kind of like that, a real custom kind of a rig, which he could simply adjust with a wrench and get it really tight. Now we're at the stage, we've taken some limbs off, hopefully safely, we're bucked it up into lengths. Now we got to flip these lengths up. Well, one of the cool things with my dad is he didn't believe in overdoing it. The zen of this activity was, like the tea ceremony, for example. You know, the tea ceremony is something you do every day. And I'm just spitballing here, but I think the zen of the tea ceremony is to say, don't take it for granted. This is an important ceremony. Your body needs fluid, very important. But your body needs you to relax. Why don't you combine the two things? I think that's the essence of the tea ceremony. Combine the two things. So my dad did that with his hand logging. He combined exercise, getting out in nature, something practical, harvesting wood, a way to teach his son, and he wanted to stretch it out. This wasn't a 12-hour marathon where we went in and at the end of the day we had, you know, logs in the wood in the fireplace burning. Far from it. This might be 3 months. So on a separate trip, we would ride our bikes home after maybe bucking it up, maybe completely. Maybe we just did some of it. So say we come back, we buck up the rest, and now we're going to start flipping them out. You typically are, he's aimed the tree towards the trail, hopefully. It's not, so some part of the tree is close to the trail. Those units you would flip down first. They're, you know, 5 or 6 feet long, some of them. Maybe 7. And he would flip them down, and then he would just sort of have them on the side of this, you know, makeshift trail through the scrub, through the brush, the light brush. And now those logs are sitting there and anyone could get them, right? So this is the point where, you know, you ride your bike home or whatever and you get the car and the trailer. And it was a trailer that, you know, one of these sort of half homemade type trailers where he had done various things, rebuilt the sides and all those kind of things on it. But anyway, it was a pretty good sized trailer and we'd go and get it and pull up to the trail. Now we're pulling up on the side of the road where we're not supposed to be. No one stops there, period. No one. So my dad would just sort of say to me, nice and calm, you know, just sort of, in other words, don't start, woohoo, you know, don't start whooping it up. This is the part where you don't really want to have to talk to someone with a hat on. So up the trail we'd scamper and we'd flip the logs down. Usually it was just, you know, 20, 30 feet left. Flip them onto the trailer and drive them home. As I mentioned in the article, I got a chance to steer sometimes, and this is, you know, underage steering, where my dad was right beside me, but he would let me, you know, steer the car and whatnot. So that was a big thrill. And you know, we talk about the load in the trailer and how when you have a trailer, the trailer drives the car, and all that was good learning stuff too. Very, you know, just sticks with you. It sticks with you because, one, you're having the treat of doing some driving underage, you know, steering. And two, because, you know, you did it. And you did it in this sort of great learning environment, this awesome kind of experience. And so it all just stayed with you. We get home, we flip the logs out, and we sort of make a makeshift spot in the side of the driveway. And that might be it for that day. Good workout. Let's go and have some tea. Or he might want to start cutting up one. Well, he had homemade sawhorses. I never really saw sawhorses like his. Other people, they make ones that are they're designed to sort of cut finished wood on. And so they're like the letter A. My dad's were like the letter X. And so you rest the wood in the top part of the X. Everything was eyeballed. You would make eyeball beginning cuts. Where did you want to cut this piece of wood up? And, how many units? Again, if it was the lower part of the tree, the units were close together. Sometimes a foot apart, really close together. And that round would weigh 20 pounds for sure. And then you'd, okay, let's do those cuts, And eventually he'd let me do the estimating. And if it wasn't quite right, he'd make little corrections. And okay, let's go at it. And again, the big thing with the cutting it up was, the nature of humans is if we have to cut up rounds, we want to get it done right away. That's just the way we are. I don't know if there's anyone that wants to take their time doing it. It has to be taught. And he taught me that. And it was really a great gift, just part of the overall gift. But the number of times he would say relax to me, just in my life, probably the highest percentage was when I was trying to sweet saw wood. With the sweet saw, if you try and push down on the wood, it won't cut. It will bind. And if you don't push down, sort of psychologically, you think, well, it's going to take longer. And yeah, there's somewhat of a relationship. The harder you push, the more it will cut right up to the point where it binds, and it'll suddenly bind. And so, again, that was something to be learned in a friendly environment. Don't hurry. Take your time. Steady, And if I was not into it that day, he'd say, let's go and do something else. Let's go and have some tea. And we would just go do something else. And it wasn't that I would come back, later and it was all done and he did it without me being there. We'd do it again, but he would just sort of wait for the best next time. So let's say we sawn the rounds up, the lengths into rounds. Now we got to decide. He would have some rounds that would go into the fireplace hole, and some that would go in as halves, and some that would go in, I guess, usually holes and halves and maybe sort of some miscellaneous if the splitting didn't go well. And the idea of these logs, they were on the side of the fire, and he called them keepers. I don't even know if this is a normal term in fire making, but this is the term my father used. And the idea is that when they start to burn, they are now reflecting heat back into the fire. The fire is reflecting heat on them, and they're reflecting on the fire, and the fire burns better. You can try this for yourself. And then after the fire gets to a certain point, maybe on the second fire, the side rounds might last more than one fire. On the next fire, they're partially burned, and then now they're going to become a middle-sized piece for them as part of the next fire, and you're going to have a fresh keeper behind them. This is where the half-sized keepers came in handy. Oh, the other thing was we used a cedar. We would get cedar rounds often, not a telephone pole, I don't think, because those would have creosote. We didn't burn creosote cedar, but somehow my father would get hold of cedar periodically. And, cedars, you'll often find them dead, and I don't know if they fall that often. They seem to be the kind of tree that sort of, becomes a permanent part of the forest because the wood, of course, doesn't rot like other woods rot. Anyway, occasionally my father would get cedar. He'd go out of his way if he, ran into a source to bring the cedar home. And that was probably the kind of case where sometimes, someone might help him cut it up into rounds. So we'd get rounds of cedar, and then it was my job to split the cedar into kindling. Kindling is a starter material. You start a fire with paper, but after the paper, what do you burn next? You want to start burning wood, but big wood won't burn readily. And some wood won't burn readily ever. In other words, you get some wet maple wood, or even our alder when it's wet, you would have to cut that stuff to the size of a straw, a straw that you drink with, or smaller, before that would sort of burn in a friendly kind of a, helpful way. And, of course, part of the problem, too, is when it's wet, is it's using a fair bit of its energy just to evaporate the water out of it. So by the time it's evaporated the water, it's half gone, and now you get some flames, but then it's half gone. It's just not effective. Well, in the kindling world, cedar holds the first, second, and third places. There's nothing like cedar. Maybe fir, in my opinion. What I like about fir, it deserves a number four spot because fir can have a good grain, and fir has a bit of pitch in it, so it's got a bit of sort of energy in that pitch. And with the good grain, you can sometimes split it into long pieces. So maybe fir is up there. In terms of common woods, if you could get oak or something, oak would probably burn great, but who can afford it? Kindling is awesome. It has oil in it that helps. It also repels water. the nature of the wood is it repels water. So it's very dry with an oil in it and has a super linear grain, which a even grain, laminar grain that allows you to split it almost to matchsticks if that's what you wanted to do. And so you can make awesome kindling out of cedar. I was allergic to cedar dust, to dust in general, especially to cedar, but I would still do it. Even when I found out I was allergic, I would take a deep breath, run to where the cedar kindling was, split some kindling and deal with it, and then run away, 10 feet away, outside, stick my head outside, grab a breath, run back, and I just love doing these activities, I guess. I don't know. I don't know why, but I did. So, now you've got kindling. You also need middle size. And so sometimes those rounds of alder would get split into middle size. So, you know, it's taken me years to sort of really figure out is, be careful in your selection of wood. When you find wood that splits well, split it more than the wood that does not split well. Whenever you have a branch, when you look at wood and you see a knot in finished wood, that knot was a branch. So whenever you have branches, you have knots, and you want to avoid trying to split that whole area, don't do it. First of all, it's really dangerous. It just takes so much extra force that you're now taking considerable extra risk. Don't do it. But also, it's just hard. I've seen axes bouncing off of knots more than success. Some of the alder would be knot free, would be, branch free, that section, and it would lend itself to splitting into smaller pieces. And so those might be, four times the size of the kindling. The kindling might be ideal shaped kindling. If you think of a sugar cube, imagine joining, 12 or 20 sugar cubes together with glue. That's a perfect kindling. About a half inch by a half inch or centimeter by centimeter on its cross section and then say a foot long. That's an ideal piece of kindling. But it can work in smaller and bigger sizes, but bigger sizes you're wasting it. Smaller, it's not quite as, durable. It burns too quickly. So middle size might be, if you could get it that small, some of it, but it could work its way up to being 2 inches. By an inch, say. Maybe an ideal middle size might be an inch by an inch to an inch by 2 inches in cross section. So there it was. There was hand lugging. You selected a tree, knocked it down, took off the branches, cut it into rounds with a handsaw, hauled it all back, hand labor, split it with an axe. We didn't use a wedge. Occasionally we would use wedges on the splitting if we had really nasty wood, like if we tried to split maple. As nice as alder was to split, that's how bad maple was. Maple is wood with an attitude. It's so warpy. You can try it sometime. Just go and look for some maple and then try and split it. Take your best axe. Just be safe. That's all. Be safe. But wood's nasty, and that's where you need wedges. Wedges, you can, once you get a crack going, you can start driving with wedges. And even if you don't get a crack going, you can just start right off with a wedge, and then you use a 10-pound sledgehammer, and you just pound away at that wedge. It's a very brute force way of splitting. Not much fun. But it's also a way, the wedges are a way to rescue your axe when it gets stuck. So, hopefully I've given you just a bit of a taste of Zen in the art of hand logging. My father, Jace, passing this on to me, and maybe maybe someone will enjoy this long-winded version of events. I think you will also enjoy my story. I think I put a fair bit of detail in there and some additional thoughts in there. So this is Floyd Maxwell for JustThinkIt.com. Good luck with your life. Take care.